We reformed in Europe Sabbath and holiday observance, as I mentioned to you before, doing away with many of the traditional laws of work, what constituted work on Sabbath, doing away with the extra days of holidays, which arose when the Jews and the Samaritans were fighting it out, and the Jews were sending smoke signals up to tell the Jews all over the Middle East when a holiday had started, and the Samaritans, getting wind of this, would send up fires and intermediate hills maybe a day early and mess up the system so that then the Samaritans' brotherly love came and able. The Jews then had to send out emissaries on horseback, or I don't know what they were then, camels, therefore they instituted a second day of most of the major holidays. We reformed these so that now that we have a calendar that can tell us, I have one on my desk that tells me the dates of all the holidays from 1900 to 2100 in the Hebrew calendar and the regular calendar, so that we have done away with the extra days of holidays. Reform in Europe, reformed traditional Jewish laws, especially in marriage and divorce, because the woman was in a secondary status legally, never realistically in Judaism, but legally she was. We changed many of the laws of Judaism. We accept the law of the land as binding in terms of civil law, and we do not make the same requirements that an Orthodox or a conservative rabbi does in terms of ritual law. We do recognize the validity of a civil divorce, whereas a conservative or an Orthodox rabbi will demand, in addition to a civil divorce, a religious divorce. Many of the Jewish laws of marriage and divorce were very hard upon the woman, especially because only the man could grant a divorce legally, although the law set up certain regulations whereby the woman could force the man to declare a divorce. But this was working around what we use as the thumb. This was the way of studying Talmud. You said, this, it says this, but it says this, and then you could turn it around. And finally, European reform did away with a lot of the Jewish mourning customs. The traditional Jewish mourning customs, of course, we bury our dead as soon as possible, if not on the same day, then on the next day. And then many of the laws of divorce during the, of mourning during the first 7 days. An Orthodox Jew does not bathe, does not shave, sits on a low stool with no shoes on his feet. And there were many other superstitions that had grown into traditions within Jewish mourning customs. Reform in Europe did away with most of these. It never became a great movement in Europe. One, because there was still much anti-Semitism, there was not much room for Jewish growth. There were still strong Orthodox government ties, even to modern times. One of the reasons that the Nazis were so had such an easy time of getting the list of all the Jews was that the Jews were organized as a community, and all you needed to do was go in and raid the community files, and you had the name of every Jew in that town. Reform Judaism was never a really major force within Europe. And the reform that we have in Europe today, the remnant that is left, and in Great Britain, is really closer in practices to conservative Judaism in America. As a matter of fact, this is something that we always say to people when they go to Britain. The reform movement there is the conservative movement here, and the liberal movement there is the reform movement here. All right, that's not important. You won't be tested on that. So, one of my professors used to say after we took notes for a whole period. We come to America and we find that Jews start coming to America with the earliest settlers, but that there are no great numbers of Jews in America until, let us say, the 1820s to the 1840s, when the great German migration comes over here, especially after the Revolution of 1848, and among many of the German liberals were many German Jewish liberals. We do find some liturgical reforms in American synagogues. Congregation Beth Elohim in Charleston in 1841 is the first. Ben Har Sinai in my hometown of Baltimore in 1842 is the first congregation in America to be founded on Reformed principles. And as you would probably guess, this was a German-American Reformed synagogue. German was the language of the prayers. German was the language which the rabbi preached in until the middle 1870s and 80s, when some radicals in the congregation said that for the sake of the children, it might be nice every once in a while to have a sermon and some prayers in English, too. So that these were mainly movements of the German-American Jews. In 1850, Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, who was the one of the two seminal figures of American Reform Judaism, introduces many reforms into the synagogue there. For this, he is rewarded by getting clapped over the head by the president of the congregation when he tries to ascend the pulpit in front of the ark on Rosh Hashanah. When the congregation had had a vote and they said, we don't need a radical reformer like this, Isaac M. Weiss, being his calm self, said, I stand on my principles, and as rabbi of the congregation, I will do this. And he had a confrontation with the president, and evidently the president won out and gave him what we call finally a clap on the head. Isaac M. Weiss then went to Cincinnati, where he became an important spokesman. He founded a newspaper, The American Israelite, which was, to all extents and purposes, the New York Times, the national paper of American Jewry. Most of American Jewry at this time was German-American Jewry. He helped found two temples in Cincinnati, which became major Reform temples, and became a leader in Reform Judaism. He helped organize our seminary, our congregational body, and our rabbinical body, and really laid the foundations for the organized Reform Jewish movement in America. At the same time, or a few years later, in the city of Baltimore, a man by the name of David Einhorn, a very, very fiery character, came to Baltimore, 1855 that was, also founded a newspaper, which was published in German, and he was much more radical than Isaac Meir Weiss in his reforms. He also came from Germany. He was run out of Baltimore during the Civil War because he was an abolitionist, and he was threatened by the slave owners, and his congregation said, well, for your sake, you better get out. And after this, he wrote a very fiery letter back to them, which I saw, in which he called them a bunch of no good chicken reformers, and if this is the way they were going to be, then he wouldn't come back to them. Einhorn laid many of the theological foundations for the radical break with Orthodoxy, which soon was to come. But I'll stop here and continue next time with a discussion of the two major platforms of Reform Judaism, the first being laid down in Pittsburgh in 1885, and then the second one, which I've given you, which you might like to look over, glance over, between this week and next, the so-called Columbus platform, which was adopted in 1936. These are the closest that we have come to any dogma or any type of guide or code within Reform Judaism. We are a very liberal branch of Judaism, a liberal form of Judaism. We'll discuss this more fully next week when we get into these platforms. And as a very liberal form of religion, we have very few guides, codes, dogmas, platforms, etc. And as you'll see when you read this, you'll probably be very disappointed if you're expecting a very definite set out way of theological document or something, because this is a very broad and general document. Now, are there any questions that you might have that I can? Right. Yes, I think it's very important to note that the three denominations within Judaism are not as separate. My speaking to you might give you this impression, are not as separated as, shall we say, Protestants and Catholics. It probably could be closely compared to the divisions within the Presbyterian Church. Although even this is drawing the analogy a little too far. The divisions within Judaism are solely in terms of congregational affiliation. in terms of everything else, there is a united Jewish community. When there was an Israel emergency campaign, this was coordinated by the Jewish Federation, which is made up of Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox, Agnostic, and Atheistic Jews, or whatever you have, affiliated and unaffiliated. And incidentally, I don't know what the latest figures are now, about 40 to 45% of the Jews nationally are unaffiliated. Roughly, yeah. So that this division is solely in terms of which synagogue you attend. On most other levels, there is a unity of the Jewish community. It's not an intermarriage, for instance. It's not considered an intermarriage by Jewish law if, say, Moses Cohn, who belongs to my Reform temple, gets engaged to Rachel Smith, who belongs to a very Orthodox congregation. They'll go to the bride's rabbi and be married, and he won't say to him, well, you have to take instruction or something like this, as a Catholic might to a Protestant, or vice versa. So that there is not this wide division. There is an ecumenical spirit among, if you want to use that term, among all the denominations, and within Orthodoxy there is this so-called neo-Orthodox movement, which I would say Rabbi Boyle represents, a modern Orthodox movement, which is moving a little towards the center. There is in Reform a tendency, even among the liberal theologians, to reinvest many, to bring back many of the ceremonies, both at home and in the temple, and many of the traditional observances which our German forefathers did away with completely, the idea being that we should get back to some of the traditions and take that which is meaningful and beautiful and use it. So there is somewhat of a movement towards the center. One of our historians, Dr. Jacob Marcus, who, I don't know if he's been here or not, he's the leading American Jewish historian, predicts that within another 100 to 150 years, there'll be an American Judaism, which will be one American Judaism. I don't agree with him completely, but I'd say that most Jews are moving somewhat towards the center. The only place where a problem might come in is in the terms of marriage and divorce, possibly, where a marriage would not be viewed as valid by an Orthodox or a conservative rabbi if it wasn't performed in terms of the Jewish ritual, their ritual, and certain documents were not signed, and then he would ask them to be remarried religiously. And similarly in the case of divorce. Other than that, people hop. I'm sure you have this in your churches. People call us up and they say, how much are your annual dues? And we tell them what it is, and they say, well, B'nai Amunah across the street is $10 cheaper a year. And they include Hebrew school and theirs, and you have a $40 fee for that. We have, very unfortunately, none of the synagogues that I know, except a few of the very Orthodox, make stringent demands upon their members. They're only too glad to accept members. I imagine this is true of most churches, too. Whereas we would rather have a person who comes in. I mean, the optimum would be that the rabbi would meet with each person and say, this is what Reform Judaism stands for. If you feel at home here, fine. If not, you belong somewhere else. We should do this, but we don't. Right. We do not make collections in our service. We are supported solely by the dues of our members. There are variations at this. Many Orthodox synagogues are supported by the tickets that they sell for the high holidays. You know, just as you have the crowd on Christmas and Easter, we have it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But most synagogues are financed by a dues program, a fair share program, in other words, depending on your income and what you desire to give. Our members, we have family membership, and our members are billed quarterly. And every once in a while, a deed evaluation committee will visit them and say, well, now that your income has probably gone up and the cost of living has gone up, why don't you raise your dues, you know, a little, and then we'll get all the excuses. Maybe it's just that, well, I never come to services anyway, so why should I raise my dues? Yes, we do. Most congregations have a type of dues evaluation committee or the board of directors will go. In some cases, when it's a very big donor, perhaps the rabbi will go, but usually it's taken care of by a board. Oh yeah. We'd like to do more than we really can. As a liberal religion, we can't really honestly tell them that they have to come. Just as I understand, you don't have to come to chapel every day like we do in the seminary. But we try to. They all come on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and usually it's traditional on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, for the rabbi to give them hell and say, you should be here. Rabbi Nadel, my senior colleague, had a beautiful image of the revolving door Jew who revolves in on Rosh Hashanah and out on Yom Kippur, and you don't see him for another year. We try to. Our synagogue has a membership participation committee now in which they're trying, how can we make our Sabbath service more appealing and so that more people will come?
Based on a little poem I once found, not written by a Jew, and it goes like this. I met a little Elfman once, down where the lilies blow. I asked him why he was so small and why he did not grow. He slightly frowned, and with his eyes he looked me through and through. I'm quite as big for me, he said, as you are big for you. And what the conservative movement has done is allowed Jews to find a place for themselves with a certain amount of individuality, not having to accept one extreme or the other, and also allowing the two extremes to find a meeting point in the center, so that if there were no conservative movement, there might be a complete cutoff between the Reform and the Orthodox, but we serve as a kind of intermediary between the two. And now, in the few minutes remaining, please ask questions and I shall try my best to answer. Yes, sir. Sam? Well, no, let me say this, that in terms, in these books here, we did not go into any godless. When, however, the Jew came in contact with another civilization, sometimes, in terms of talking to this other civilization, he did develop a kind of dogma. So, let's put it this way. In Hellenistic times, we had a Jew like Philo in the period of the Spanish Golden Age, you had a person like Moses Maimonides. Now these men did engage sometimes in theological disputes, but always with the sense, and maybe the best way of answering would be to say this. Maimonides was very taken with Aristotelian concepts, and he tried to fit Judaism into a mold, and in doing so he had to use a certain amount of dogma and so forth. And then he said, but he disagrees with Aristotle in the question about the eternality of matter. He doesn't believe that there is eternality of matter. And I mean, his creation story would go against the eternality of matter. But he said, but even if it could be proved to me that there was eternality of matter, it wouldn't change my understanding of Judaism. I mean, it's not so crucial to Judaism. So the short answer to that question is that there have been discussions such as that. And there are discussions today too. But it doesn't become so crucial to the being a Jew. In fact, in some of these stories, I don't come across the right way, but as it comes up to me, I'll just give it to you, and it's a hit and run. I don't have to see much of it again. But this is the story about the two Jews who were sitting in the discussion, is there a God or isn't there a God? I mean, now this is real theology, and you can't get much better than that. And, back and forth, and then one of them says, oh, we better stop, it's time to pray the afternoon service. Meaning, there's a certain kind of, there's one thing discussing theology, and there's other thing being a Jew, and following the requirements of being a Jew. And so this is, now, if that doesn't answer, that's, just ask me again. No. I would say that the strain is so pure, if it is pure, I don't know how pure it is, but however pure it is, it's only because of external factors which have made it very difficult for people to want to become Jews. Now, there was in the 10th century or so, there was a large portion of Russia, southern Russia, the Khazars, who converted to Judaism. And we don't know, who in the synagogue may be a Khazar, and I mean, it doesn't matter. We've always been open to converts, although we've never been missionizing, but even there is a question. But we've always been open to converts, and once a convert becomes a Jew, there's no difference in Jewish law between that Jew and the convert. So that there is no real sense of any kind of strain or genetic strain involved here. And in fact, it is said that right before Christianity, about one third of the Roman Empire was involved in, not from the strain of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but had converted in one form or another to half Jews or Jews. And so I again would say that it was a mix. Yes, I would say definitely it is. Of course, when a convert becomes Jewish, he is given a name, which is given a name, the son or daughter of Abraham, as a symbolic kind of anybody who is a kind of Jews have a great defense from Abraham, if you will. Well, let me say, first of all, that sometimes it's just a question of the power that the specific group has at the moment. Now, when the Jews lived in a ghetto, it was much easier to draw a line, because if a Jew did something which was wrong, and he were, let's say, excommunicated from the community, then he had no place to go unless he wanted to convert to Christianity, because as a non-religious Jew, he wasn't any more accepted by the Christian, let's say, than as a religious Jew. I mean, he was still a Jew. And therefore, most of the Jews towed the line. In a society today, which is a very free society, and we're very thankful to the Lord that we live in such a free society, there is the disadvantage, you might say, of there is no power to make a Jew go in one direction or another, even if we could. And the second part of it is that it's not easy to draw a line. I mean, this is one of the problems of Jewish law. But even if we could draw a line, what can we do about it? I mean, if the Jew doesn't care about it, so he doesn't care about it. The question not so much the question is not so much how many details you can get the Jew to observe, or but the question is how much of a of a religious soul can be developed in him, and what's the best way of going about doing it? Well, I would say that it depends on which rabbi you're talking to. But the moment you have accepted the basic premise of the rabbinic interpretation of law, then you're not on very safe ground in terms of being able to draw a line. The first one who said,
this doesn't exactly mean what it is, opened up the dice.
And from then on, it's just, and that's where a kind of community aspect, it sort of, it rests a lot in a tradition, in accepting the tradition, and then in seeing where something in the tradition is going around and then saying, let's do something about this, and you can do something about this. There are certain areas in the law, for instance, which, and even the question of whether a Jew who becomes a Christian, I mean, just to say the extent of the problem, I mean, at least you might say, well, a Jew who becomes a Christian, you don't have to be a Jew, you have to be as you want. But if you're going to become a Christian, and only a Christian, if you go become a monk, or a brother in a monastery, a Catholic monastery, I mean, who's going to question it? No, but there's a question there. Now, just a few years ago, you may recall there was a great problem in Israel because since the state of Israel was organized as a refuge for the Jews, the government came out and said, anyone can become a citizen of the state of Israel, you have equal rights, but a Jew automatically gained citizenship. Just like there was a time, I think, when a soldier's wife or in the United States automatically gained citizenship when she came over here, you have different categories of citizenship. But there was this Jew who converted to Catholicism and became a monk, and he went to Israel and his name was Brother Daniel. And this Brother Daniel claimed that he wanted to become a citizen of the state on the basis of the laws of Ukraine, or meaning an automatic Jewish citizen. Now, the government didn't want to keep away his being a citizen, he was going to be a citizen, but they said, oh, but you're not Jewish, so how can you? Well, they brought it to trial, and it was taken to the Supreme Court. And at that time, the Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, saw what they were talking about. He sent a letter to 100 of the greatest Jewish scholars in the world and asked them to define what is a Jew. I mean, this is almost like they really draw the line. And he got a lot of different answers. And finally, the Supreme Court came to the following decision. Brother Daniel could not receive citizenship as a Jew. Why? Not because he wasn't a Jew, but because the law about automatic return was stipulated in 1948 or 49. And according to the Supreme Court, in the minds of those who drafted this specific law, those people who have no refuge in the place else. Now, as a Catholic, you certainly have refuge in the place else. Therefore, the Supreme Court says, I'm not saying that Brother Daniel is not still a Jew, even though he's a Catholic. He still is a Catholic, and he still is a Jew. But he can't come back under the law of the Lord, because he isn't a Jew. But even that, there has not been agreement on. So the question of drawing the line makes it a very, it's the famous story, I guess, of the Jew who has marooned on a desert island, and when they find him, there are two buildings there, and they asked him what the two buildings are, and he said, this is my stand out, and they said, what's the other one? They said, that's a stand out, I've never stepped foot in. Now, this is a kind of, it's a part of a kind of independent spirit which has been fostered through the years by this openness, even within the most traditional people. And it causes an answer to your question, which is a good question, and it protects us many times as rabbis in many areas, to say that, to be honest, there's no end, there's no line.
Would you say that it would be unthinkable in Jewish theological circles to ever have to Did God deliver Israel from the house of bondage to the next city? I'm asking, did there ever in the same or did it be manna by the line of the test?
Well, rather than put titles on it, let's not say whether it's a theological question or not. The rabbis would discuss the question. Like, I may not be questioning your question. So, I mean, if you might want to put it in a different order, but let me just say this, that there will be those Jews who would say, who would be more naturalistically inclined, and would be those Jews who would be more supernaturally inclined. And those Jews who are naturalistically inclined would see, let's say, God's acting in history much more dependent upon how long goes the historical act, rather than so much on God's actual participation in the historical act. The supernatural view, they would be probably in that sense, I mean, in a more fundamentalist tone, and certainly, God did this in his work. How did he do it? Oh, that's really the interesting problem. I mean, you see, even, let's take the question of the giving of the Torah. The giving of the Torah. Now, God entered history, gave man his law. Now, did God do it? Yes. How did he do it? Well, the Torah itself goes out of its way to make it difficult for us to talk about how he did it. Because he talks about the fact that the people heard the lightning and saw the thunder. Why did they hear the lightning? It isn't something to talk about. It isn't in terms of the natural events that we understand them. So, no matter what point of view we take about God and his action in history, we immediately are limited because we have no terms to talk about. We have no language to speak about. Whenever we're speaking about God, we have to always be aware of this tradition that we're speaking in the language of men. And what we're saying, it doesn't really matter that much. The word may get us into more trouble than if we kept silent. And this has been one of the factors in the limitation in the mouth of theology. The only, if you turn to the prayer book, you know, this is probably the best theological book that you could go to. I mean, one of the just say it when it gets up. It's a big thick book, and you've got a lot of things to say. If you go through it, you'll find very few statements of what God is like, or something like that. You find more things reminding us of what God would do if a person is stripped, he cares, and if a person is naked, he cares, and therefore you have to hear, you have to close, and so forth. You're in the image of God, therefore, if God does this, metaphorically or whatever it is, then you have to do this, and so forth. In terms of the mix, in terms of the act and your living is in man. The first question is easier than the second question. The first question, I can just say to you that Christianity is much less of a problem, let's say, than maybe some of the polytheistic religions in the times of ancient Israel. But even there, the category of being saved would go. Meaning, just as I tried to de-emphasize theological import here in the discussion in terms of Judaism and theology, just are not that involved, you must realize everything I say here is on a superficial level because I have to go into these things and more than, I can give you a course on Jewish theology too. But, the fact is that your religious belief, your dogma, will not affect your salvation in that terms. It doesn't matter what you believe, it matters more how you act in the world. That's what was, makes it change. That would make, Now, as far as the second question, and luckily I don't have much time, because it's not an easy question. Just going to answer very briefly and say this. A more fundamentalist view would say that he has a place in the world to come, meaning in the resurrection of the dead, and whatever the world to come will be like. A more liberal view
this worldly life would say, well, whatever the Jewish sees in terms of salvation, in terms of being at one with God, then this person will receive no matter what his religion is. And no matter what gods he believes in or how many gods he believes in, but his salvation in liberal terms would be just like the girl who is much more naturalistic in his belief. Meaning it won't depend upon God again, but his connection with the cosmos, so to speak, will be last done, will be tied, will be made, no matter what tradition he is, and that's what salvation would mean to the liberalism. Salvation to the more fundamentalist view would mean we keep the world for eternity.
And